Wait. Before we start, just want to make sure we're clear here. While this podcast talks about sobriety, mental health, and addiction, it is not meant to replace professional medical advice. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety.
I'm Kathleen.
And I'm Sonia.
And we're ex-sisters-in-law, brought together in marriage and bonded through our sobriety journey.
Join us as we talk sobriety, addiction, and everything in between. You're in for quite a ride. And our Substack is buzzing with amazing content, from creative mocktail recipes to insightful courses and reflective exercises. There is something for everyone. Don't miss out. It's a great way to add some extra joy and depth to your journey. Check it out. Welcome to Sisters in Sobriety. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by Bella Ferguson. Bella is a certified This Naked Mind coach and co-host of the popular podcast Not Drinking Alcohol Today. She shares her story of transformation from navigating high-stress corporate environments and the social pressures of drinking to ultimately making the life-changing decision to embrace a sober life. In her early career as a lawyer, she faced the intensity of drinking culture and found herself turning to alcohol to manage the demands of her job. Bella took a brave step towards sobriety, and now she uses her experiences to guide women to live authentically without relying on alcohol. Hi, Bella.
Hello, Sonia. Thank you so much for that introduction.
I am so excited you're here, and it is election day in America, Wow. So we're stressed.
Stressed, I imagine. Wow.
I do remember like past election days where I would drink and now cannot drink. So I'll just be like up all night. So you were a lawyer, and in your experience as a lawyer, how prominent was drinking in corporate and social settings?
Look, it was everywhere. And I'm sure that you could find a little subculture if you were a non-drinker, but I think like kind of hangs out with like, and certainly in all of the groups that I was a lawyer in and gravitated towards, big drinking culture, work hard, play hard, permeated. Yeah.
So did you feel that expectation in that corporate world to be in that subgroup? Was that the subgroup that was getting made partner, or how did you feel about it?
I guess I wouldn't have felt a pressure, but it was certainly something that was promoted, and it was just everywhere. So alcohol was there when you had to market to clients, and it was very much a status that was associated with marketing to really important clients. So I guess in that kind of setting, the expectation was that you'd partake in the expensive champagne or the expensive wine when you're marketing. And it was, it was there when you needed to debrief with your group, also to celebrate at work conferences and work functions. There really wasn't much of a part of the law firm, except when you were doing your billable hours behind your desk, where alcohol wasn't involved. It is very much a part of connection, bonding, marketing, and de-stressing. Yeah. So if you are that kind of person that has already got alcohol on the periphery of your life, you have used it because you've grown up with it as a teenager and then to high school and then at university, then you're going to keep on using it in your firm because you want to belong and fit in. And you're also really stressed. So it kind of tackles you from both ends. So, look, it's everywhere. It is an issue, and the stats kind of show it as well.
Yeah. So I do this a lot in like different situations. When you look back, can you see a way where you could have done that without drinking? Where there was somebody else maybe even doing it?
I don't think I could have because of who I was. I think it can really capture people that you are diligent and hardworking and smart, But you might have some core issues there that relate to belonging, self-esteem, self-worth, your intelligence, you know, things that develop from your childhood and your teenage years. If you've got that within your personality type already, and then you're thrust into this corporate environment where all of those things come to the fore in the surface when you are highly stressed, then on top of that, if it's culturally promoted and available, you are going to gravitate towards that as your means of self-soothing. And that's exactly what I did. So the only way that that pathway wasn't going to play out like the way it did was if the culture in the firm was different. There was really a top-down leadership which promoted not drinking. It made it a free choice. It really turned it on its head from what it is, what it was in that time frame. Yeah, it's a hard one to look back and see how would it play out differently. But I think it's a cultural systemic issue.
Oh, for sure. Did you see a difference between men and women and how they approached that drinking culture?
That's a really good question. I haven't really thought about it in that way. I think in the culture that I was brought up in as a lawyer, men were very much in the leadership, dominated the leadership in terms of numbers. Women were not as represented, but we were slowly getting there. So to be included in that drinking culture, I think as a woman, you wanted to be part of the group. You wanted to be at that debriefing table and show that you could keep up with it all. So I guess there was that then added layer of drinking like the men to be included. I think the other layer of it, now that I'm thinking about it, is that women really have it differently in terms of that 35 to 40-year-old bracket. When you have earned your stripes and worked your way up to quite senior levels, but then there is a bit of a lifestyle shift. If you are thinking about having kids and needing time out, you're juggling then a whole host of extra stresses in your life. So you kind of need to dip out a bit. Everyone manages this differently. I can really only talk from my perspective, but you jump out, you've got maternity leave, you're trying to work out how to keep your foot in that corporate door and to be taken seriously, so that when you come back, alcohol then might be creeping in more on the home front. You're then working a bit later, trying to juggle the demands of both lives. So drinking can ramp up on two fronts, because you're trying to manage the stress, but also you're wanting to connect and fit right back into that law firm socially and at the big end of town. And drinking, if it's still there, is where, you know, it can slowly creep in again on that front as well.
Is that what happened to you?
Well, I guess it probably did. The way that I describe it, a functional drinker for about 20 years. For a couple of years towards the end, I was then very much in that grey area drinking front, but on the higher end, and grey area drinking in the terms of was drinking beyond more than I wanted to, and was taking steps to try and stop, but kept on finding myself back where I was. It was certainly something that crept into my life when I was a lawyer and I had my kids. So the whole ball game just shifted for me then. By then I was a senior associate, really looking towards partnership, and my husband was working extremely long hours as well, and then I had these tiny kids, and I was a stepmom as well to two gorgeous girls, so there were four kids at home, and it was hard. It was a hard juggle, and alcohol that was my go-to means, because I had no other ways of self-soothing that I really knew about. That was really creeping in at that time. When I then tried to get my career back and work back after my kids, the stress was just incredible. There are 101 plates spinning in the air, and it was just the norm to come back home. My husband would have his bottle of white. I'd have my bottle of red. You'd juggle with the kids. I would often do it myself because he was coming home late. And then I was working again at night. And then it was a vicious cycle, the lack of sleep, the fatigue the next day. So it was just my avoidant, self-soothing behavior of choice that then took on a whole life of its own.
Yeah. That's exactly how I would describe it too. So at what point, after repeating this cycle for how many years, did you reach that moment that pushed you towards thinking even about quitting?
Yeah, I was one of those people that hit a pretty nasty rock bottom, to be honest. So, and it happened, funnily enough, when I left, I couldn't sustain the balance any longer. My anxiety was through the roof. I must have just been, you know, running on a threadbare nervous system. Mm-hmm. So I left the law and decided to try and find some balance and spend some time with my kids. And it was then that alcohol really took on a life of its own, because I didn't have the structure and the external validation. My identity was so tied up in working and productivity outside. And I loved being at home with the kids. That was awesome. But then I also then threw myself into mummy wine culture. This whole new world was in front of me, where I was suddenly able to connect with the mums at the school and in my neighbourhood. So the drinking just took a different turn. There was then lunchtime socialising drinking, and then long lunches, long parties, and then into the evenings, you know, kind of the lunches then blurred with the evenings. And alcohol then became something that I was drinking just to feel normal. And to cut a long story short, it just got to the point where I was drinking before I was going out anywhere. I was, gosh, at my worst, drinking two and a half bottles a day. Wasn't really touching the sides. My husband, though, knew. He was, you know, poor thing, was pulling his hair out, trying to work out what was going on and how to stop it. So lots of big conversations were had. And I was, yeah, trying to pull back. But by that stage, I would have been physically addicted. So, you know, it was just dangerous. And it got to a point where one night I had just drunk so much and my husband found me quite unresponsive. So I went to hospital, and from there got a nasty shock. I think it's not overstating it to say that alcohol nearly killed me. My blood alcohol level was massively high. And there was a beautiful, beautiful doctor who just said to me, look, you've got a fork in the road moment here. If I send you back straight away, I don't know where you're going to go, where you're going to end up. But if I put you on the ward and you make some phone calls and check yourself in somewhere and do the work, you might just be able to pull it together and start, you know, living the life that you deserve, your kids and your husband deserves. And that is what I did. And if it wasn't for that act of kindness from a doctor that had a brother that had gone through the same thing, so she got it, then things might have turned out quite differently. But there's no skirting around the issue when I say that it had got so problematic that it almost killed me, which is frightening because I love my life.
So I'm not a parent, but when I think of mommy wine culture, it's the suburban mom with the picket fence and the husband. And so you talked about how your husband knew there was an issue. How was it affecting your relationship?
Gosh, Sonia, you ask such good questions. That's a goodie.
I feel like these are the questions people want to know when they're thinking about quitting. They're like, how do I talk to my spouse?
Well, I just tried to hide it, and I was in full flight denial. I couldn't contemplate a life without alcohol, and I was protecting it, hiding onto it for dear life. And of course, I didn't know where it was going to end up. And I thought I could just deal with this myself and become a moderator. So He would come home at around 9 o'clock at night. By that stage, the witching hour had long passed. The kids were in bed. I'd probably had a few long lunches. And it had just continued on. And I would be trying to hide how much I'd actually consumed. If I was actually awake on the couch, often I was asleep on the couch. So the conversations became quite frequent where, babes, what are you doing? And I was like, no, I'm fine. And you've just got to stop. He was saying, this is just too much. This is not how I see our marriage playing out. I'm fine. I've got it under control. I know what to do. I'm going to stop. It was just that again and again and again. And I would say that went on for, it probably went on for about 3 years with the frequency building up towards the end. Because, you see, we started as big drinkers together. That was the way we socialised with all of our friends. It was just what we did, you know, long lunches with many bottles. The recycling bin was a full bin most gatherings that we had. So I couldn't conceive of not having my wine. He then just started to find bottles that I was hiding. And whether that was in the recycling bin or in my cupboard or wherever, you know, got really clever at trying to stash. And that's when it really dawned on both of us that things had taken a strange, sneaky, secret path. And he's a lovely, lovely man. There was never any "I'm going to leave you" conversations, but I can remember it did get to one night where he did pack his bags and he did go and stay in a hotel, and he just said, "You've got to sort this out. I can't live with this. I don't want to live with this anymore." And that was a turning point moment, because, you see, after rehab, I still tried to moderate, and so it happened after that. And that was fear. That was from him, and fear in me that made me realize that something had to give, had to be alcohol.
So I know this happened to me, where the way you meet your spouse, those early years, you're drinking, you're out with friends, and then all of a sudden you're in your late 30s, and it's like, this is not what it's supposed to look like. And then, oftentimes you think, oh, I thought we were drinking the same amount, but you weren't. And you have to have that conversation. Are we going to keep alcohol in the house? How much are you going to drink? Are you going to moderate? Are you only going to drink when you go out? I've had all those. So what was that conversation like?
Well, he was obliging and willing and keen to do anything. So he was all up for, shall I remove every bit of alcohol from the house? Shall I not drink at all? And I didn't want the spotlight on me, because when I came back from the treatment centre, I was just so full of anxiety and that shame. How am I going to integrate back into my life without people thinking that I am just a fool, I'm broken? I wanted to get that self-esteem back, and I didn't want the spotlight on me. So I just said, you do you, please just continue the norm, so as for me not to make it feel so weird. And that's what we did, certainly with some bumps in the road. It was not suddenly, hey, I've gone to rehab and I'm back and life is rosy and look at me now. It's rarely ever like that. There's a lot of shifts and layers under there. So this is what it's going to look like. So where we are now is that his drinking has now substantially changed, because I probably was the instigator in our household. He always had an off switch. Rarely did I ever see him inebriated and slurry. So we just were very different in our drinking styles. And I think we're healthier and better for it. Our relationship is so much better. It was heading toward a massive collision that was probably not going to be repairable. So Yeah, I mean, we're fitter, happier for it.
Are you looking to reset your relationship with alcohol? Look no further than our self-paced 7-day reset program. In just 1 week, you'll gain the tools and support you need to kickstart your journey to a healthier, more balanced lifestyle. Our program includes daily audio, helpful exercises, and guided reflections. And best of all, it's on your time. Head over to sistersinsobriety.substack.com and let's take that first step together towards a better you.
Yes. Yes. So when we talk about rehab, how did rehab and any programs that followed, how did that help you gain clarity on your drinking?
It was just the first, door opening. It was probably the one door of the next 1,000 doors that I had to go through. It was not a quick fix because how can you possibly get a quick fix in 4 weeks? Particularly when at that point I was very much still in protection mode, wanting to hold on to this, keep one foot in both camps. Mm-hmm. And because I wasn't very self-aware, I didn't appreciate what alcohol did to our brains and our bodies. I didn't appreciate perhaps it was connected to some negative core beliefs that I had, that I was drinking. I didn't understand it was a self-soothe, that it was a avoidant behavior. I just didn't get it. And on top of that, my nervous system would have been just threadbare. And I had no internal knowledge about nervous systems and how they worked and how it made me feel. So there wasn't that interoceptive awareness around how to be grounded, how to breathe. I didn't know when I was stressed. There was a whole lot of learning. Like, we were starting at a let's teach this person how to regulate level. And so, I mean, that takes years, really.
I think that's the emotional sobriety. And I didn't.
I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even think I thought about it until a couple of years in. I think I was like, white knuckling
right.
it.
Yeah. 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 You took the words out of my mouth. You're right. The first 6 weeks is different to 3 months, which is different to that year. You've got all your sober firsts and you're managing the cravings and you're all of that. And then, yes, then there's this, the emotional sobriety, all of that letting go of other behaviours that are avoidant behaviours as well. It keeps on going, isn't it? It's a whole exercise that will probably never stop.
Yeah, I totally agree. If I started drinking when I was 15, I'm sort of stuck there in a lot of ways. So I have a lot to figure
That's
out.
Right.
So I just had a client. I'm sure you have tons of clients that are trying to figure out if they can moderate or if they need to quit. And I never make that decision for them. But what advice do you, or what are some things you ask people when they're trying to figure that out? Or what are some things you tell them?
Yeah, look, often I have clients that will say, well, I know I'm on this alcohol free thing. That is my goal long term, but I've got this function coming up. Would it be okay if I just have one or two? And my response is always the same. I'm neither fine with it, or not fine with it. This is you. You do you, and you work out.
Did you know your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age. Plus, get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent right to your door. By tracking your biological age, you can actually see how the changes you make, whether it's to your exercise, diet, or sleep, affect your health over time. It's about taking actionable steps to improve your well-being. Oh, and if you are wondering about high-profile people taking it seriously, Brian Johnson, the guy who's working on reversing aging, and I watched his documentary on Netflix, uses True Diagnostic to track his progress. Ready to find out your biological age? Right now, our listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code CIS2025 at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TRUDIAGNOSTIC.com. Just use the code SIS2025 to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today.
If that was okay for you, how did it play out? How do you wake up feeling the next morning? This is what you've got to go through to work out if this is going to work. There are times when I will just say, look, but these are the statistics. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the person. Where was their level of drinking at before mm-hmm. they came to me as a client? Very different to have the person that is a binge drinker every now and then versus a person that had been hiding bottles, habitual drinker, who has previously had to go through some treatment to get through physical addiction. So you've got to meet the client where they're at, mm-hmm. and they've got to work it out themselves in the long run. I don't think it really helps at the start of any client counselling relationship, from my perspective, to say,
yeah.
Well, that's it. That's the line in the sand. You'll never be able to moderate ever again. And I think for many people who are alcohol-free and have a year under their belt even, the never-say-never thing can really make you feel quite closed in and claustrophobic and fearful. So there is something to that one day at a time, pause, yeah. and then ask yourself the questions, is this really what I want? Is it really going to give me what I'm seeking? And if you've done the work and you get to that point, then more often than not, you're going to say, hell no. But yeah, everybody, I can't really think of, only one or two clients that have said, yeah, I'm alcohol free from this day. That's all I want to be. It's hard to unravel decades of drinking in one foul swoop.
And I think the fear, I just could not imagine a weekend without alcohol, and there's such fear there. And you think, well, if I can just drink on Friday and Saturday nights, maybe then, because what am I going to, I think deep down that there's a whole new world that you have to create. So what do you think, other than the social aspect, what are other people's biggest fears about quitting or having a life without alcohol?
I think what they think is their fear list never really quite is on point. So initially the fears are fears around socializing, fears around getting through boredom and loneliness, fears around tapping into that carefree, adventurous youth, fears around getting into the mood, the energy thing. I think they're just the surface fears that we all go to, that we think we drink about. I think if you really tap in and sort of ask them a few more questions, probe a bit, it comes down to some core beliefs. Fears around feeling emotional stress that is derived from self-esteem issues. I can't really think of a client that I've worked with where it hasn't gone back to fears around their likability, their lovability, their sense of self-worth, their sense of are they intelligent enough, good enough. Those essential core beliefs that make us human. Now, when there's some resistance to that kind of inquiry, say, well, you probably think you are lovable and likable, and you are in most areas of your life, but situationally there are just things that trigger those core beliefs. Could be on a work front. It could be being left out of a friendship dinner, or it could be just something that has sparked that ruminating, intense core feeling that you never want to feel again. And it's often come from a childhood experience or an experience in your adult life that has just really stressed you, traumatized you, a breakup mm-hmm. or a a work thing, a bullying thing that has triggered that feeling that you never want to feel again. And so at all costs, you try and engage in avoidant behavior, and that's where alcohol comes in, so that you never want to. And I think that's hard to really explain to people, because we'll say, I'm sitting at home and I'm just in the habit loop of getting my bottle of red wine and pouring my glass of red wine at night. And then you've just got to dig in. Well, what were the feelings that you're sitting with before you're thinking about that glass of wine? Mm-hmm. Why can't you sit in that moment? What are you fearful of? Where's this going to go? Where are your thoughts going if you were to sit in there? And often if you kind of dig, you ask them, well, what then? What then? What do you fear if you just sit with it then? It often comes down to, sorry, that's my dog. It often comes down to, oh, well, I'm fearing that I'm missing out, fearing that I'm unlovable, or I'm feeling like sitting with yourself home alone can often bring up big feelings you're trying to avoid. And that kind of exercise can play out socially and when you're other people as well. But we're both humans. I think we're complex, but we're also quite basic. We really desire some very core things around our self-esteem, to feel connected and loved. And if there's been something in our experience which has challenged that, then there's some wounds there that have yet to heal. And until we process those wounds, it's going to really upset our nervous system. And we're going to drink to try and put the fire out and soothe those feelings.
So, yes, I think that I have not met anyone whose core reason was not something around self-esteem, belonging, fitting in, identity. And for sure, it was for me. So what I'm thinking, one of the scariest things to me is a group of mommies drinking wine. So what happened to the mummies? What happened? Where are they now? Did you end up staying friends with them? Did you make new mummy friends that didn't drink? How did you navigate that?
Oh, yeah. Gosh. And of course, you've hit right on the probably one of my core beliefs there that was really underpinning why I drank, which is that great fear of not belonging or of being abandoned from my friendships. And I can, you know, really call on some examples from my childhood where that would have been triggered. But so, yes, I was lucky in that a lot of those mums were also thinking that they were drinking a bit, and they've pulled their own drinking back. And they were fairly solid in their love and protection of me. So, and in fact, a lot of that, there was a big friendship group. We all just went wild. We turned 40 and we all just went mental. It was like our kids are now at school. We've got a bit of time in our hands, and we acted like teenagers again with one another. And for people like me, I took it too far. So with those group, that same group that I was doing all of that with, in fact, we're getting together this weekend. But this time we're getting together to go for a trail run and then sit at the beach and connect very differently. So I was lucky in that sense to be able to allow it to play out in quite a healing way in my friendship groups. Now, there is, though, of course, another breakaway friendship group that still have big parties, still really socialize in that way. And I was included a little bit, but no, that's kind of fallen off. That's fallen off. And there is still a part of me, I'm not going to lie, that thinks, hey, why aren't I still connected? Why aren't they inviting me? I can still have fun. In fact, I'm more fun. But if I really was to sit with that and journal it out and reframe it, I'm a bit grateful that I'm not, because, the conversations are repetitive. You often get stuck with that alcohol bill at the lunch.
It's so not I as live fun. In a small town in Pennsylvania, and it's pretty like,
You are on that. Sorry. You are in the state. You are in the election state.
That's, yeah. So I, sorry yeah, to it's a in. Small town. No. And And it's pretty heavy drinking. It's mostly people, like a lot of them are retired and they have a lot of parties. And so I went to a New Year's Eve party, started like around 9. And so it was progressive. It went from one house to the next to the next. So we get to the third house. Oh, wow.
Yes, I remember those.
Oh my God. Yeah. And I think, oh, look at me just killing it with my phony Negronis. Like I'm just crushing this party. By the time we get to the third house, people are trashed. And I walk in and one of my neighbors mistakes me for the only other Indian girl at the party. And I think he was like, hey, wow. How you doing, Anita? And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And I thought, oh, dear. I'm gonna exit before you say something else, and I have to see you tomorrow. And it was sort of the vibe of the party. Like people were getting, they were drunk to the point where they were gonna say things that were offensive or they didn't remember. And so yeah. I got home at like 11:15 on New Year's Eve, and I'd never been happier. And actually, it's so funny. I saw that guy today when I was voting.
But voting booth.
I saw him today, and I was like, "Hey, Bill. Who do you think I am today?" Like,
yeah, you remember those things, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
It really lands because perhaps, I don't know about you, Sonia, you probably had it together a hell of a lot better than I did. But I was an idiot. I was that last one on the dance floor with a cigarette in my hand.
I was the one saying to like my husband's friends' wives, like, I heard he's cheating on you.
Oh, yes.
My ex-husband now, and he would be like, what did you...
Yeah, I've had a few conversations.
I keep asking people if they had cocaine. Do you have any cocaine? You got any cocaine? Anybody have any
cocaine? Let's keep this going.
So embarrassing.
It is. And it kind of comes from that desire to, I think... And I'm not justifying it, but you want the party, you want the connections to go deeper. You really want to get, the desire is to connect and you think you want it to continue. You want this party to keep going. And it just goes exactly the wrong way. Yeah.
Yeah. So that night I get home on New Year's Eve and I have these go-to like self-care things or things I know I'm going to do when shit goes south. And so one of them is I know I always have a show I'm going to be watching on Netflix, and I always have like ice cream in the fridge, and I always have mocktails and popcorn. And so those are my like low level self-care. So get home from a crappy cocktail party and I'm like, I'm going to watch Bridgerton and like eat mint chocolate chip. What are some of your self-care?
Oh, I like yours. Your household sounds very cozy and lovely. That's the party
alone.
I want to be at. I want to be in my pajamas with popcorn watching Netflix.
Yeah. You can only do that when you're a single 46-year-old woman.
Yes. I think exercise at all costs it just has to be 5 to 6 days a week of a pretty varied, fun routine. I need my sneakers, and I think my mood just hits a bit of a low, and that's probably part of it, because I think alcohol is that searching out for dopamine. So exercise has to be there, and really good nutritious food. It just in an easy way. I'm meal prep, and it's healthy, and it's we've got this meal plan system. It's called Marley Spoon. You still cook it.
And we have Marley Spoon.
That's just works for me in my household. Yeah. I wish I could say I've got a pretty consistent grounding meditation practice, but I don't. But it's there, and I'm trying to bring it into my life. So a 7-minute gratitude meditation. But what I have become a whole lot better at is just knowing when I am activated. So I'm a big fan of Jolene Park and her approach of the bottom up, that yes, we can do a lot of cognitive work, and that's important, but the source of it all is our nervous system and our neurotransmitters. So these days, unlike right at the start, I'm pretty clued into when I'm at a beautiful calm mode and there I'm making good decisions, or I might flip my lid, as Jolene says, and you're in activated mode. And that can be from a conversation. It can be from not doing my exercise and all the rest of it. So knowing when I'm in that mode, I'm now really good at regulating and just asking the questions. What's going on behind the scenes there? What core belief is this triggered? And it's usually a core belief around connection and, you know, all of those things we've spoken about. I also know that I've got that ability to kind of drill down into work and go down a rabbit hole. So I've got a very important reminder to myself that I need to pull out and connect with a friend a day. So once I do that, if I keep that routine, all things seems to be going pretty nicely and is pretty balanced. It's not always the case though. It sort of ebbs and flows, and I think it can be the case with a lot of drinkers, ex-drinkers, that you tend to be all or nothing people. You're all on a nice, healthy self-care routine, or you're not. You're in bed with salt and vinegar chips and Tim Tams and Netflix. And don't get me wrong, I do that. I hit those moments where I find myself at the shops getting my chips and my Tim Tams, and all I want is to watch is whatever show it is at the moment. I've always got a lot on the boil. And I think that's an indicator for me. That's a real indicator that something's off balance and a bit of a red flag to go easy. Do it. Have the Tim Tams. But knowing that the next morning I always wake up feeling shit and it's time to get the sneakers back on. So that's the routine. There's no quick fixes. It's just keeping things in balance, I think.
I think it's so important. I think a lot of us ex-drinkers have this tendency to isolate when we're going through a tough time. Mm. And so making yourself reach out to a friend, like I make myself do it. I really do. I force, when I can feel that I'm spiraling a bit and like things are going around in my head, I reach out to somebody and talk it through. And it's like, oh my God. What was I? Yeah. And I think that's, even if it's not, it doesn't have to be a sober friend. For me, it's like my sister-in-laws. And like, I feel it's so important to have that.
Yeah.
And have a plan.
It really is. And I think you've hit on it there. The withdrawing, the avoiding, self-soothing in other ways. And I think drinkers aren't, not everybody, but not so good at processing emotions. And that's the emotional sobriety and resilience. And often if we've been avoiding with alcohol for years, it shows up in many other avoidant behaviors in our life. People pleasing, scrolling, emotional eating, the sugar, the trying to control outcomes, you know, trying to, because you're wanting to keep the peace, make everybody happy, or perfectionistic behavior. So all of those, they're signs that, and if you're a drinker that self-soothes, you're often ticking the box on many of those other things as well. So it's good to become aware of that, because there's things you're not processing that you just need to learn the skills. Call a mate, journal it out, whatever you need to do to get those feelings out in a different way.
Yeah, you touched on that workaholic tendency, which I think is one of those coping mechanisms.
So
can you tell us a little bit about how an alcohol-free lifestyle changed your passion and?
Yeah. Well, I was a good litigation lawyer, but I would probably say I wasn't particularly passionate about it. I was certainly that person standing around. Maybe, you know, there's more, isn't there? There's more to life than just these advices and court work. So probably a part of my drinking was an avoiding of a feeling that I was lacking a sense of purpose. And then that comes down to probably not having a strong sense of self that comes to, which a lot of drinkers don't have. So when I had quit the law and my alcohol had ramped up, there was part of me that kind of knew that something had to give. I do need, we all need structure and a bit of external validation outside of my family structure. So I did see a career counsellor, and it was the best thing I did, because this is before I'd hit that rock bottom. She said, you're just ticking all the boxes. They do all those questionnaire things. I love it. Yeah. And counsellor was a career that came up there, and it kind of worked. I thought, yes, I could do that and work from home and look after the kids.
Yeah.
So the seed was planted. And when I was in the treatment centre, I started studying to become a counsellor. And this was well before I studied under Annie Grace and Jolene Park.
Yeah.
But that really, really lit the fire. And I think in hindsight, because it was teaching me about self-esteem and confidence. So I was trying to heal myself and work out what was, yeah, what, where was this identity that I was looking for? We all sort of do that. And I have no doubt I transferred my avoidant behaviours into studying. That then became what, yes, I threw my attention into. But the, at least it was a healthier version, a healthier version. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it, being on the other side of that problematic tug of war with alcohol has just enabled me to work in a career that means a lot to me and really fulfills me. It connects with my purpose, allows me to continue on studying, and is manageable in my life, so I can still keep the balance on other sections. Like, I couldn't do that with law. It was just 100% law. But yeah, but here there's a balance. So touch wood, it all continues kind of working. You know, I can still learn. I can still learn. There's always things to learn in this sphere of counselling. Got my family, got my exercise, got my personal growth, and they are my values, my core values. Mm-hmm. And if I can live in alignment with those, then things feel right. And
yeah,
when things are out of balance, that's when we have that internal friction that we soothe with. So if I can keep it feeling good, then then I'm a happy lady.
I think that's a great spot to finish. So can you tell us what is new and what is on the horizon for you?
Oh, well, thank you, Sonia. Well, the two things that I do, I run 6 weeks alcohol-free challenges with in small groups of women. So what are we now? We are I'm the 6th of November, but you might still be the 5th, I imagine.
Yes,
are
it's
you
the 5th of
November?
Yeah.
So we're day 6 of our November alcohol-free challenge, and that is my passion. That's one of my favourite bits of my counselling, yeah, practice at the moment. Next one's in February, and okay, and I have a 6-week alcohol-free course that's solely online and self-paced. So that's the online version, and my challenges are the live version, the face-to-face version.
Yeah.
And they're the things I love. I'm always improving and tinkering, yeah, with it as I learn more.
That sounds amazing. We will link to all of that in our show notes. And thank you so much for being here, Bella.
Oh, thank you. And Sonia, just for asking the good questions, getting in there. It's wonderful. It's always food for thought. It allowed me to think about things I haven't thought about, yeah, for a while. So thank you. It's been a lovely, lovely hour.
And thank you for listening to Sisters in Sobriety, and we'll see you next week.
This was Sisters in Sobriety.
Thank you for listening and being with us today.
If you want to learn more about sobriety and meet your community, find us at sistersinsobriety.substack.com.
Are you a sister in sobriety? Then reach out on social media. We'd love to hear from you.
If you're feeling generous, leave us 5 stars and a review and follow us wherever you listen.
You'll never miss an episode. Until next time.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition, roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.